Special thanks to C.H.R. Hansen, a leader in fermentation and innovative brewing solutions. C.H.R. Hansen's range of high-quality yeasts includes Smart Bev Near, which crafts flavorful beer entirely without the alcohol. These yeasts even enable fast, climate-friendly, and cost-efficient production. We thank C.H.R. Hansen for their support and commitment to excellence in brewing. This is the Master Brewers Podcast, brought to you by the Master Brewers Association of the Americas, a volunteer organization dedicated to continually improving the products and processes of our membership since 1887. Let's go! 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 Master Brewers brings you interviews with the industry's best and brightest in brewing science, technology, and operations.
Calm down, I'm moving too fast.
This episode was made possible by the following sponsors.
Discover more ways to enhance flavor and maximize beer yields with Salvo. Now available in varieties like Sultana, Trident, Lotus, Calypso, Cascade, and many more. Discover how Salvo can help boost your brew at hopsteiner.com.
Berkeley Yeast, creators of diacetyl-free yeast strains. Diacetyl-free strains are bioengineered to produce the ALDC enzyme inside the yeast cell to keep diacetyl low during fermentation and after packaging. Diacetyl-free strains create the cleanest flavor profile possible, which makes them the yeast of choice for the most exacting brewer. Go to berkeleyyeast.com to read about how brewers are using diacetyl-free strains to propel their beers to the top of the podium. Grist Analytics captures and trends data across the brewery so you can see issues as they are happening, not several batches later. Get real-time feedback on the brew deck, analyze correlations from the lab, and see scheduling predictions from anywhere. Connect Grist with your ERP platform to cover your brewery from production to finance. What you're about to hear originally aired in May of 2020. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode that you won't want to miss. What happens when someone reaches out to suggest a podcast topic? We put together a dynamic group of Master Brewers members to talk about that topic.
We're running at a max of 4 bar on the back pressure, and although I'm sure it's different machine to machine, is there any kind of guideline as to what is too high in terms of back pressure?
This week on the show, Becky Rudolph has great questions about centrifuge operation, so we mobilized a small army of industry peers to provide great answers.
My name is Becky Rudolph. I am a quality assurance and cellar manager with Great North Aleworks in Manchester, New Hampshire.
My name is Lawrence Wildskit. I'm with Bell's Brewery. I've been here for about 11 years and working on a fuge for most of those.
I'm Morgan Harry, cellar manager at Odell Brewing, Fort Collins, Colorado.
Stephen Larley at the Old Hickory Brewery. Brewmaster, do everything, basically. We're a small company.
Hi, I'm Andrew Conlin. I'm the director of brewing operations here at Heretic Brewing Company in Fairfield, California, and happy to be here.
Hi, I'm Chris Clausen. I'm a centrifuge engineer and the craft beverage industry manager at Trusant Separation Technologies.
Hi, I'm Marco Garcia. I'm the technical brewer here at New Glarus Brewing Company in Wisconsin.
Hi, my name is Zach Kelly. I'm with Russian River Brewing Company. I'm the lead production brewer at our new Windsor facility.
Let's talk about best practice for solids removal pre-centrifuge. I'm sure this depends on yeast selection as well as other ingredients and process, but how many days of cold maturation with cone drops do you require in your process?
Once we've turned down to 32, we usually let the tank sit for 2 days and we dump solids both of those days. So you've got to turn down to 32, dump day, and then we fuge on that following day.
And how's that working out for you?
It seems to be okay, although our yields are still not quite as good as I'd like them to be. So I'm wondering if another day would help or any change in our process would benefit us. So hopefully I can get some answers on that today.
Okay. Zach, what are you guys doing?
Optimally, we're going for about 2 to 5 days. We don't remove any solids until the actual morning of. Our tanks now have standpipes in them, so we'll remove from the true bottom and then the standpipe down the beer.
Okay. And Morgan, what's Odell's doing?
Yeah, pretty style dependent, but typically at least 3 to 5 days again. Doing some good drains before refuging, obviously. Dropping out most of the hops, getting to yeast and harvest yeast if needed, and blend in as much of that during the actual centrifuge run as possible.
All right, Steven, how about you guys?
Yeah, it's really dependent on the style of beer, of course. Over half our production is lager, so it sits for 4 or 5 weeks. We typically don't dump the solids until the day of centrifuging. If it's a beer that's going to be dry hopped, we'll dump yeast and then dry hop, and then we'll dump that before we go to the centrifuge.
Andrew?
So it's, like everybody is saying, based on style, but it's also just based on the production schedule. So we centrifuge probably about 5 beers a week. So we'll crash on a Monday, and then usually about 4 to 5 days in, we'll centrifuge over. We've tested different amounts of days, and we've found that our yields change depending on how many days we allow it to sit. So we've tried to do a little bit earlier, and we found that our yields drop quite significantly. So we find, the longer you allow it to sit, the better.
Okay, let's hear about how you go about blending in the tank bottoms during a run. What's a typical procedure for that?
This is something that we've been discussing a lot recently. We'll get the fuge going, and then we'll kind of start to open that bottom valve and blend in. And we'll kind of adjust it throughout the run depending on how the machine is reacting and our NTUs. And I don't know if that's the correct process or not, but that's what we're doing at this point. I think sometimes we overreact a little bit. And don't let the fuge itself take care of the solids. So I'm wondering if we should just be kind of cracking that valve and letting it go, or if we should be monitoring it throughout the process.
We actually have made a little rig that basically attaches to both arms at the same time, so both the racking arm and the true bottom. So after dumping everything off the very beginning, generally everything still settles out a little bit during the run. So we will come directly off of this standpipe until we get a good run going. Our DOs look good. Everything's flowing really smoothly. And then we will also, like you were saying, just crack back that bottom valve just a tiny bit, just so you see a little bit of movement come in there. And if you see any negative effects on your discharges or anything like that, you can kind of troubleshoot back and forth.
Centrifuges like stability, so if you're going to, when you start mixing in the tank bottoms, if you're, you're going to get an increase in solids, you can slow the flow rate down on the centrifuge to compensate for that. That way you have a more stable centrifuge discharge turbidity, and you give the centrifuge a little more time on the more turbid beer out of the bottom to be able to meet the spec that you're looking for.
We're already running at a pretty slow flow rate. We're running at about 10 gallons a minute, and that's for our heavily dry hopped beers. So I feel like that's already pretty slow. Can we slow it down even further, or is that kind of getting into a range that's too slow?
No, I mean, you can slow down as far as you need to get the results that you're looking for on the outlet. And as you're running, your inlet will become less turbid, so you can increase that. So generally, when at the start of the run, the flow rate will be, say 10 GPM, and then as the run clears the cone or the bottom of the racking arm, you can increase that flow rate so that at the end of the run, you could be running 50 GPM.
Yeah. Just to add to that, you're going to have a minimum speed that you can run on your centrifuge. So one of the things is, as you decrease the speed on your centrifuge, you're going to have to increase the back pressure on the discharge in order to kind of keep the machine packed and avoid any shearing or cavitation inside the bowl. So one thing that you want to watch out for as you increase that back pressure is making sure that beer is not coming off the top of the bowl because you're overfilling it.
So we have done a few experiments early on with doing a double draw system where we pull from the tank cone and from an upper port in the tank. But typically we're just sending everything through the cone nowadays. Our centrifuge is able to automatically adjust flow rate to inlet turbidity, which is very nice. In our larger system, we have a very manual, slower flow rate, but it'll drop down to 25 GPM when we're running really thick stuff. And then when we're running clear, it'll go up to 75.
All right, great. Looks like Morgan has something to say.
Yeah, so in the past, we would typically use like a kind of a Y setup where we're mainly pulling off the racking arm or a standpipe and then blending in the cone. But we actually stumbled upon these flexible impeller pumps at CBC a few years ago. And they're these really small, virtually no shear, they're EPDM impeller-driven pumps. It's like a 1 square foot footprint on the ground, but you're able to run it at like 1 hertz to you know, a little bit above that, but just very slowly dose in, so you get a very stable inlet turbidity. And again, it is very important if you are able to adjust flow rate on your inlet turbidity to handle any slugs, any little hiccups, that is going to save you on the outlet. And again, just really slow, stable, consistent blending on the inlet, as little fluctuation as possible, keeping everything consistent, like people have been saying.
How about best practice for running multiple brands on the same day? In other words, how do you manage that transition from one brand to the next? Is that just a beer flush, a water flush, a full CIP? How do people manage that transition?
We're kind of running 24 hours, starting up Sunday, running the one or two centrifuges through Thursday or Friday sometimes. So we are just doing like a good thorough rinse, getting a bunch of ejections done, just to flush out the bowl, flush out the discharge side, just a nice cold rinse and no CIP. We go right into hot kill and purge.
We do a big deaerated water flush in between our runs, and then just clear out the bowl.
At Nuglaris, what we're doing is we do a deaerated water push as well, 3 large shots to clear out the bowl. And what we'll do is we'll actually look at the drain, because the large shots are going to go down the drain and make sure that that comes out clear, and then we're able to move to the next brand. Previously, when I was at Miller, in addition to doing that, we could also do flying changes, so brand to brand changes by knowing the push out amount.
Yeah, I was going to ask if anybody was going beer to beer. Anybody else doing that?
Yeah, John, this is Lawrence. We have done a few different ways. We've gone beer to beer with certain brands. It kind of depends on the color, flavor profile of the beer and yeast strains. So we've done deered water pushes. We've gone straight beer to beer with brands, and we chase out with sensory through a black and bleed. But we have a lot larger volumes that we work with, so it's small dilution factors in there. But we also have done deered water pushes, like everyone else has said, and as well as just a full-on CIP and resanitation after as well.
I schedule based on yeast and also just based on, you know, the amount of hours in the day. We definitely don't do 24 hours, but we'll do a full CIP between different brands and then a resanny.
Okay, let's hear about process loss, and perhaps for anybody whose brewery is somewhat new to centrifuging, any data they might have on yield increases.
I don't necessarily have any data on yield increases. Previously, we did not do such a great job of tracking our transfer volume, so that certainly doesn't help me in assessing how we're doing with the fuge. But I can tell you that for our highly hopped beers, we're yielding about 80%. And for the one non-dry hopped beer that we do, it's about 94%. And I don't know if that's a decent yield compared to what others are getting, or if these are numbers that could be improved somehow.
Yeah, we're seeing for dry hop beer about 8%, and then for non-dry hop beer about 1.7% in loss. And just, you know, we were talking about cone drops. We actually don't run the cone, the dry hop cone.
Why don't you run the cone?
Well, I mean, there's a whole slew of reasons. I mean, those that have, you know, when you pump out your hops, like hops just make a mess. Like they'll get into the buffer tank that's feeding the centrifuge, makes it really hard to run. We'd have to put it in recirc over and over again. And quite frankly, you know, the long and the short of it is, if you take the hops in the cone, you spin it down and you taste it, like the supernatant, it's just not that good.
At our big centrifuge, we typically see losses between 1.5% up to 10% to some based on brewed volume versus what came out of the centrifuge. On our smaller fuge in our pilot brewery for 13 barrel tanks, we see anywhere from 11% to 26%. It all depends on the beer. We do centrifuge a handful of our beers warm as well, so I'm sure that has a factor to do with it, but that's typically what we see for our losses.
So this is Marco. I just wanted to add to that. So for losses, like, we do talk about flow rate quite a bit, but I would say if you're looking at your yields, the most important thing that you can do as a brewer is understand how big the solids holding space is for your machine. So if you know if it's, you know, if it's, you know, 5 gallons or, you know, 30 liters, whatever that number is, and your manufacturer can tell you what that is, or your vendor can tell you what the holding capacity of your machine is, take that number, multiply it by about 85%, and make sure that your discharges are not bigger than that. Or I guess another way of saying is that know what your solid capacity is and make sure that your discharges are the correct size.
Does that sound about right, Chris Clausen?
Yeah, absolutely. Knowing what that volume is, you can dial in your discharge. And if you do a spin down on a benchtop centrifuge, 3600 RPM for 2 minutes, and you'll get your volume by volume of solids. You can also take that and calculate out, if you don't have automation, you can calculate how long it's going to take to fill that 80 to 85% of the solids chamber and shoot on that time based on what you're based on the feed that you're seeing. To do that, though, you have to have a pretty consistent inlet and adjust that time based on how much solids you see coming into the machine as best guess. That's where some automation with turbidity meters and programming come in to take the human factor of that out. If you can optimize your run to increase the time between shoots, you'll have better efficiency. After a shoot, the hydrodynamics in the bowl get disrupted, and it takes a little while for them to settle back out. So if you can increase the time between shoots without building up too much solids in the bowl, you'll run more efficiently.
Let's hear about your typical DO pickup during a run. Marco, what's yours?
Maybe one on a shot. We're basically essentially at zero.
Okay. Andrew, how about you?
Yeah, so we'll test the tank before we centrifuge just to make sure that it's at the proper DO, which is essentially zero PPB. And then it depends on the style, but we tend to, like Marco is saying, we tend to keep our centrifuge below about 2 to 5 PPB.
Steven?
Yeah, we're typically between 1 and 3 PPB on a pickup. Really, I think it depends on the length of the run, how much hose we have to move from one side of the plant to the other.
Morgan.
Yeah, so we're measuring the inlet and outlet on the centrifuge on every run, and we're typically seeing mid to high teens on the inlet and low 20s on the outlet. Virtually no pickup, essentially.
Zach.
We are also seeing very low pickup, if anywhere, generally in the low single digits. probably a little bit due to our carbonation in line afterwards that does any additional kind of polishing for us.
All right. Lawrence.
On our larger centrifuge, we will typically see somewhere in the same thing, around low teens to mid-20s. We do have an integrated alarm light, so anything over 50, if we're having some issues, it'll send a strobe light going off outside of our room. On our pilot brewery, that we're still dialing in. We're looking to find the right flash to identify the best way to identify that, but we've seen below 50 numbers and as high as 100. So it's just very small runs that happen very, very quickly. So it's been tough for us to figure that out just yet and getting the right meter to measure that. But we're still learning on that one for sure.
At a higher level, let's hear briefly about sort of the relationship of beer flow rate to beer clarity / NTUs.
My understanding, and someone can correct me if I'm wrong, certainly is a slower GPM will lead to better NTUs, but I don't know that for sure. That's sort of just what we've seen. The other question I have is, how are people controlling their flow rates? Because we only use the back pressure to do that, but I sort of got some a sense that there's a different way to do it that maybe we are unaware of.
So as far as the flow rates, you know, as Chris had pointed out, that, you know, you have a certain holding capacity in there. So if you're going slower, you're just allowing more time for the beer in the machine to settle out. So yes, if you run slower, typically you will have a better clarity on the discharge side. That being said, I have seen cases sometimes where running faster is better. I can't tell you why, other than the universe has a sense of humor. As far as the flow rates, yes, you should have two valves on your machine that control flow. You have one on the discharge and one on the inlet. And those are both flow control valves. Now, any brewer worth their salt knows that if you have a pump, you're going to put your flow controller on the discharge. And the centrifuge is essentially a pump where the beer moves, but the pump is stationary. So it's kind of crazy when you look at it, your flow control valve is actually on your inlet. And that's what I was saying earlier, that if you go too slowly, it's kind of like putting your finger on the hose and it will spray right out. So if you close your flow control valve on the inlet of the machine, you need to proportionally increase your back pressure in order to keep your machine packed. Likewise, the faster you go, you need less back pressure to keep that system packed.
Yeah, I think there's one thing we've kind of like skimmed on. Just the overall bowl speed of the centrifuge itself plays a lot into this, and it can be kind of adjusted depending on your brand in conjunction with flow rates and discharge timings and these other things. But just the bowl speed, dialing that into the particle size that you're actually trying to strip out, whether that be yeast, hops, just playing with that a little more can add a lot. But yeah, like I said, flow rate is a big part of it, but kind of having a pump on your inlet, providing that stable flow rate. And like we were saying, the back pressure can play a lot into it. If you're going too low and you're having to put a lot of back pressure, you can end up stripping and causing a lot of breakout in your product. But yeah, I think starting with bowl speed and moving from there is pretty key.
Do you want to give some general numbers out there for bowl speed for various applications?
Yeah, I think somewhere around like 4,500 is a good starting point generally. And going plus or minus from there will get you where you want to go.
I mean, more like, can you give an example of like a practical application where you want to run it slower, and how slow would you go?
Right. So I mean, clear brands like 90 Schilling, we can run the bowl speed a little quicker just to pull out particles quick, run the beer through at a higher flow rate overall. But with the development, a lot of these hazy beers we're seeing these days, we still want to run them through the centrifuge, strip out a lot of the hop particulate, but maybe not some of the enzymes and proteins that are helping our haze. So lowering the bowl speed in the in the case of like the hazy stuff, even some like wheat beers where you want to maintain your haze can help a lot. And you'll see, just kind of as a rule of thumb, I kind of teach our operators that one ejection for every 10 barrels is pretty safe. Again, like if you're having too many ejections, you're just dumping beer down the drain. That's just kind of a measure of like how long the bowl is staying open during that discharge. So kind of managing all these factors, it's a lot to play with. There's a lot of variables. But yeah, kind of ramping up and down from that 4,500 mark has proved fruitful for us.
All centrifuge separation is bound by Stokes' law, which is a physics law. There are several different variables in it, but when we're talking about the flow rate, it goes to a part of that equation that is the force that the beer is seeing. So it'll be different for each make and model centrifuge, because the bowl diameters will be different, the solids holding capacity will be different, the disc stacks inside will be different. So it'll be dependent on each make and model. That's why it's really important to keep notes on the runs when you're learning your particular centrifuge on each beer. The overall answer is yes. The slower you run the flow rate, the more clear beer you will have, because the beer's going to have less time in the bowl for those particles to separate. The back pressure is very important also to keep the bowl filled and to keep shear rates down. I would adjust those, and I recommend adjusting flow rate and back pressure first. The higher the back pressure, the more clear beer you'll have. The lower the back pressure, the more turbid beer you'll have. Adjusting those first, and then if you don't see the results that you want, work with your manufacturer or your supplier to decide what a safe RPM for your centrifuge will be. It's important to talk with a manufacturer or a supplier about what the safe range is, because there are vibration harmonics at certain speeds that can do damage to internal parts on the centrifuge. But if you just have an open communication with your supplier or manufacturer, they can tell you where those are, so that you make sure that you're getting the results that you want, whether it's a brilliant Pilsner or a hazy New England. You can find the combination that works, but it is really important to take notes so that you have something to look back on and say, all right, this worked, this didn't, when you're first getting a recipe, if you will, together for how to run the centrifuge for that particular beer.
These machines are dangerous. I always tell people in trainings, like, they are, for the size of the machine, it's a fully loaded Grand Caravan, family of four, all their luggage spinning at 4,800 RPM. That's a lot of weight. And so be very careful, as was mentioned, never overspeed your bowl. Work with the vendor. And I'm glad Chris mentioned the vibration harmonics, because, you can get those machines are designed to be unstable at certain RPM, and that's by design. So if you ever want to kind of see this in your own brewery and you have trending ability, or just watch it, watch your vibration monitor on your machine as the machine starts up, and you're going to see somewhere from 2 to 3 peaks as it comes up. And those are those harmonics that Chris was talking about.
Coming up.
Let's say the machine came to a complete stop and you're trying to bring it back up. The first thing that's probably going to stop you is vibration. If the solids are packed in there and have dried up.
I'm John Bryce, and you're listening to the Master Brewers Podcast from the Master Brewers Association of the Americas. There's really only one thing that keeps this podcast going, and that's when listeners like you take the time to thank our sponsors. The next time you talk to a rep from one of these companies, be sure to thank them for their generous support.
Carry Biomatex L-ALDC, especially formulated to break down alpha-acetylactate, the precursor to diacetyl. Brewers use Biomatex L-ALDC to speed up maturation time and prevent off flavors. Think movie theater popcorn butter. Even at a low level, this is considered undesirable in most beer styles. Adding Biomatex L-ALDC to wort before fermentation or during transfer can reduce those diacetyl compounds, ensure quality, and help you turn more beer more quickly. Learn more at bsgcraftbrewing.com.
Get to know Proximity Malt. We malt superior, European-style, low-protein varieties grown close to home in Delaware and Colorado. Domestically grown, precisely malted to style. With our team of seasoned experts and two brand new malt houses, try what's really new in malt. Check us out at www.proximitymalt.com.
Positively impact your process, product, and profitability with actionable insights from BrewIQ, the industry-leading real-time fermentation monitoring solution. Visit www.precisionfermentation.com/MBAA to start saving time and money today.
BSI, your brewing partner since 1996, is your destination for top-quality liquid yeast cultures, lab services, and brewing products. BSI customizes your yeast orders for the perfect healthy pitch rate from a collection of over 300 strains. Most strains ship within 7 days, but now try BSI's Express Yeast with industry-favorite strains shipped the next business day. As of 2023, BSI is proud to be a 100% employee-owned business. Professional brewers can call for a free same-day consultation or visit brewingscience.com to access over 50 years of brewing expertise. Are you sure you're getting the best deal? Visit the Lupulin Exchange, where you can find every hop variety, every brand, and every vendor. Compare prices, reviews, shipping speeds, reliability, and more on over 1 million pounds shipping direct from every hop merchant and grower in the U.S. The Lupulin Exchange. One stop, all the hops. And here's what's coming up on the Master Brewers calendar. District Texas meets virtually March 21st. District St. Louis's March Shop Talk will be at Blue Jay Brewing March 21st. District Philly meets March 22nd at Workhorse Brewing in King of Prussia. District St. Paul Minneapolis meets at the Minnesota Craft Brewers Conference March 22nd. District Montreal meets March 27th. District St. Paul Minneapolis has a bowling social April 2nd at Town Hall Lanes. The District St. Louis Spring Quarterly Meeting is April 8th. District Northwest meets in beautiful Hood River May 10th and 11th. The Master Brewers Brewery Maintenance Systems course begins June 6th. It's time to save the date for the 2024 World Brewing Congress. That's August 17th through the 20th in Minneapolis. Check out the full calendar of events at mbaa.com for more details or to find a district meeting near you. Now back to the show.
Well, if our NTUs are running at, let's say, 60, and you know we're blending through the cone and they jump up to 120, should we leave it alone and let the machine make its adjustments and take care of that? Or should we be shutting the valve, decreasing the back pressure, and trying to bring those NTUs back to where we want them? Or is it safe to let the machine do that on its own and assume that, you know, it'll all wash out in the end when we've got our full, you know, volume of beer in the bright?
So I guess that kind of depends on how automated your centrifuge is. We currently have our old centrifuge, which is now in our Funky Brewery, and we also have a fairly automated new Alpha Laval as well. The Alpha Laval will change its own discharge and its own like turbidity, its inlet speed and outlet speed, kind of based on parameters that we set based on what we want our maximum speed to be based on turbidity. On the manual, more manual, older machine, we do have to do a little bit of balancing back and forth. We actually use dial valves on that machine to kind of regulate our inlet flow. And then we'll use the back pressure to kind of make sure we're not getting any sort of breakout or anything like that. But it really does come down to what kind of machine you're running. And I think that if you're running something a bit more manually, that's going to come down to also your preference. Because if you're blending in, if you're coming out at that higher NTU and that's not to brand, then obviously you're going to want to make some changes and not necessarily just let the centrifuge figure itself out.
And just to add to that, one more thing. A lot of people will run a centrifuge prior to a DE filter so that they can reduce the yeast load to it. If you see a giant spike in the NTUs like that and your filter's not ready to hit or to handle that, that could probably knock you out or cause you to pressure out on your filter. So again, like Zach said, it depends on what you can handle downstream, whether it be a quality aspect or what your equipment can handle.
Okay, we're going to move on and talk about carbonation. Listeners interested in that topic should check out a link in the show notes for an Ask the Brewmasters thread on the same topic. But let's hear about how each of you approach carbonation. Are you doing that in line or as a separate process or what?
So our carbonation is it's well after the centrifuge, though to kind of add to it, especially I would imagine a lot of other brewers are seeing that considering how low the DO pickup is coming across the machine, is that we do sometimes see that the pressure of the CO2 on either the hydrohermetic seal or in the space or in the hood, can actually get picked up in the machine. So sometimes you can see as much as about a 0.15 volume by volume CO2 pickup coming across the centrifuge.
All right. Andrew, how about you?
Yeah, so we've tested doing uncarbonated beer through the centrifuge and haven't had luck. We've had a lot of DO pickup. It's something that's kind of on my list of things to test. But for now, we do carbonation before we send the beer through. So maybe people could answer this, but we've had issues with, you know, a beer being lower carbonated, you know, maybe 2.1 or 2.2, and that causing a pickup in DO. And ever since we've dialed in on our carbonation method, we've had no DO issues on the centrifuge.
Anybody want to comment on that specific issue before we keep going down the list?
Yeah, that'll be dependent. I'm assuming you have a hydrohermetic seal. That'll be dependent on that seal and how much CO2 you're putting into the centrifuge hood. If you're seeing higher DO pickup, it's most likely because there's not enough CO2 in the hood space. When a centrifuge shoots its solids out, it creates a low pressure moment, which will draw in that hydrohermetic seal water and whatever gas is behind it. So it might be where you're picking that up.
I would agree with that, that we've been able to run probably beer with as low of a carbonation as about 1.6 volumes across the machine and not have DO pickup.
Okay, great. Let's keep going down the list. Steven, what are you guys doing? Are you carbonating in line or before or what?
No, we're carbonating once the beer goes into the bright tank, then we'll carbonate the beer with just, you know, through a CO2 stone.
All right, Morgan.
Yeah, we're using inline carbonators on the outlets of our centrifuges. And then if we need to bump up in the bright, we can. Typically, we're hitting spec on the outlet into the bright, though.
Zach?
We are carbonating directly out of the centrifuge. We do use a pretty significant amount of back pressure in the bright tank and head pressure on the fermenter while we're carbonating, and we generally see spec by the end.
And Lawrence?
Yeah, we're doing a little bit of both at Bell's.
I'm a little bit unfamiliar with our current setup since I moved to our pilot brewery, but I believe we have the capability of drop chiller after the centrifuge if we need it, as well as it's a good idea sometimes to have a buffer tank before doing another process after the centrifuge to get a nice steady flow. It could have issues with filtration and other equipment as well. So, but typically for most of our large volume brands, we're throwing inline carbonation after going through a drop chiller.
Becky, what are you guys doing?
We are not inline carbonating at all. We're waiting until the bright is full and using like a spin carb process to carb the beers, which works for us, although we certainly have considered inline and would be interested in anybody's setups or you know equipment that they've invested in and they feel is worthwhile.
I wanted to shift gears and talk about, there was an interesting post on the Acid Brewmasters community site about fruit going through your centrifuge. I don't know if anybody had a chance to read that or has their own experiences kind of commenting on things like seeds and whatnot. So I'll shut up and see what people have to say about that.
Fruit is a great application for centrifuges. So you'll find when you add fruit, you get kind of the yogurt, and a centrifuge can process through that yogurt really efficiently. Fruit compacts really well in the bowl, so your return is pretty significant in those applications. You do have to be careful of abrasive materials, so things like seeds can cause some damage. They can get stuck in the disc stack, so you want to make sure that the particle size of whatever is going into the centrifuge is smaller than the disc stack spacing that you have on your particular centrifuge. You can help control that by, before adding the fruit or puree, running it through a strainer to make sure that whatever is going into the vessel is smaller than the disc stack spacing. The abrasive nature of seeds can increase wear and tear on the machine, so keeping up on maintenance is important if you're going to be running fruit that has seeds in it as well.
So a game I like to play with our manufacturers sometimes is Will It Fuge? So I'll reach out to them specifically on certain ingredients. But some centrifuges, you can get a wear strip installed in your slots of your bowl to help protect the metal. Some of the things can be very abrasive, like seeds, coffee grounds, anything slightly hard. Straining before centrifuging is also always a really good option, but sometimes without those centrifuge or the wear strips in there, you can do some pretty heavy damage if you don't do it right. I mean, you'll be able to run it for a couple months or years, but it'll take its toll and do some irreparable damage to your bowl if you're not careful.
Let's hear about polish filtration or just how bright you can get with the centrifuge.
For people looking for a centrifuge or haven't purchased one yet, if you talk with your supplier or manufacturer, there are centrifuges that can produce a high enough G-force to get down to about a half a micron, remove about down to a half a micron, and will produce a brilliant beer. It won't get down to the 0.45 for sanitation, but it will get very low. It will also increase the life of any filter, polish filter that you put on after it.
Okay, cool. Let's talk about next this topic, if applicable, if any of you guys are doing it, is the hot side cinch separators. Anybody doing that in their breweries?
That's the primary reason why we purchased the centrifuge. Is to spin our kettle, and that's where we see the biggest ROI on the machine. I shouldn't say that's why we bought the centrifuge, why we bought that centrifuge, to replace our aged DE filter that was dying. So it was a twofold. But a typical day is our centrifuge runs twice. In the morning, it's running bright beer. And while the brew house is brewing, and then in the afternoon when it's time to transfer, we don't even CIP in between. We just flush it with water and then run the hot side through to fermentation, and then it's a CIP.
Okay, these are not quiet machines. Does anybody want to talk about noise levels?
So wear your earplugs when you're around a centrifuge. That's all I can say about it.
Yeah. So ear protection at a brewery is obviously incredibly important. So we've got over-ear protection for the centrifuge and for our canning line and for our mill. So just make sure you have it accessible to all employees so they can easily get it, or earplugs as well. You have a dispenser, so it's very easy to have access to it.
Anybody want to talk about the dangers associated with custom work or parts not approved by the OEM?
I think, I've seen in my previous position with a different brewer, I have seen a lot of machines tear themselves up. They do not go down quietly, I guess is probably the best way to put it. And that's even using the OEM parts. So, I mean, I think it's just a straight up general rule. Don't use, parts that are not from the OEM, especially, because you could also void your warranty. If you have the vendor coming in and doing the maintenance work for you, you need to let them use their parts so that if something goes wrong, you can go back to them and say, hey, dude, what's up? But I just say that's just dangerous and stupid, to be honest, because that machine is so deadly.
In a worst case scenario, the bowl becomes unbalanced, and that can happen either because a chunk of solids gets discharges from one side of the bowl and not the other. The other way it can happen is if you're replacing too many of the rotating parts without rebalancing the bowl, or parts that are being used weren't intended for that particular bowl. A lot of manufacturers have other vendors that they work through to send out with their OEM parts, but it is absolutely best practice to use OEM parts for that for the particular machine that you're using. Even if you have two of the same centrifuges in the plant, keeping the bowl parts for each of those machines in the correct bowl is very important. Each bowl will have a serial number, and a lot of the major rotating parts will have that same serial number on it, and it's important to keep the parts where they're intended.
Yeah, fully agree. I will say, if there is somebody out there that just really, really, really wants to work on their centrifuge or send it to the machine shop down the road, the only piece I've successfully been able to do without the OEM support would be the motor. So after a lot of use, obviously, if you need that motor rewound, that can go to a machine shop that's local. But anything that's rotating, stick with the OEM.
Let's talk about CO2 concentrations and safety in regards to that. So some people I know put these things in a small room. Does anybody want to comment on that type of situation?
We actually enclose both of our centrifuges in a room and have ventilation and its own drain and everything enclosed in that. It helps keep our micro samples kind of isolated so everything stays as clean as possible, keeps the noise level down on the discharge. And we do have monitoring throughout the cellars, including the centrifuge room, because we do have operators entering there to take those samples, obviously. So monitoring, keeping a lot of signage for safe levels and limits is pretty key as well.
Okay. Anybody else?
I've never had an issue with CO2 concentrations. There is a lot of CO2 getting used in that machine. I would suggest that if you are seeing higher concentrations of CO2, then it's probably the seal on top of your sludge catcher, because all that hood CO2 is also going to kind of flow into that. That would be my advice if there you are seeing a problem with it.
So I think it's important to mention that CO2 use is really dependent on the make of the centrifuge. If you have a hydrohermetic seal, then you're going to have CO2 and deaerated water consumption. If you have a centrifuge that has mechanical seals, is operating in a different way. It's not using CO2 or water to create the seal. So if you have a machine that has mechanical seals, it shouldn't be an issue.
And is it safe to assume everybody's using deaerated water for the hydrohermetic seals?
Yes, definitely.
Yes, absolutely. You'll find out pretty quick if you're not.
Lawrence, I know you want to talk about sort of having a plan for your waste stream and how that's evolved over the years at Bell's.
Early on, we sent all our centrifuge solids to the drain. Obviously, at some point, the city it became irresponsible to do so as we grew as a brewery. So we started collecting those at our wastewater treatment facility, and that had a screen built in where it would catch the solids. Periodically, that would have to be dumped out manually with a forklift into a waste bin that went to a composting facility. Our original attempts to do this, to send it to a secondary solids tank, did not go so well. What we saw was we didn't have the right size pipe or the right size pump to get it to the distance you wanted to, and we ended up compacting our pipes pretty bad and also blocking up our centrifuge really bad. So we did not have a built-in divert to the drain at that point. So our centrifuge filled up with solids pretty quickly once it got clogged up. So we did a redesign. It took a number of years and different attempts, but we finally got the right size pump and right size piping to do so. So we did a lot of testing with what our the consistency, viscosity, density of what our solids were coming out. And we were able to control our solids tank spray water to kind of control some of that viscosity. So when we were running through really thick solids and getting a lot of solids through our discharge, we're increasing our water, and maybe not so much when we're running at very low inlet turbidity. So we have our inlet turbidity kind of controlling the amount of water we're putting into our solid stream to get a consistent reading, and we could use that to spec out the right pump size for that.
We actually discharge into a separate like solids grant that we can manually pump out. We have a couple of solids pumps located throughout the brewery to manage our liquid waste and solid waste. We send that out to a solids tank outside. It's like a 600 barrel tank that actually gets pumped out by our rancher, Lujin. He takes our spent grain, takes all the solids out, and again, everything that we rinse out of the tanks after we centrifuge them, all the discharges get pumped out to that. So we don't actually put any of that. We try to put as little organic through our water treatment as possible to minimize our chemical use and any just effluent to the city. We want to mitigate any kind of solids going down the drain. So we try and capture all that and pump it out to Lujin.
Okay, awesome. Lawrence brought this one up too, which I thought was pretty good, and I bet it's something a lot of people don't think about before they start one up, as he said that power outages can be bad. If your bowl is full of solids and comes to a complete stop without a discharge, you got a problem.
Yeah, that does happen. Depending on the length of time that you're down during a power outage or any other failure of the machine, some machines have, I always call it a fly catcher, where it catches it on the fly as it's spinning down and starts it back up. Not all machines have that. What you really want to be cognizant about is, let's say the machine came to a complete stop and you're trying to bring it back up. The first thing that's probably going to stop you is vibration. If the solids are packed in there and have dried up. And most machines will not even let you get up to full speed if you have a high vibration on startup. And at that point, I would say that the only recourse is to take the bowl out and clean it by hand.
Let's hear about everybody's favorite topic, preventative maintenance.
So preventative maintenance, obviously on all equipment, is incredibly important. I think it's maybe a standard that's in the beer industry that we kind of wait until things fall apart before we work on them. So I would say with all equipment, make sure you go through the manual and figure out what can be done preventatively with the centrifuge. We found it was best to bring out the manufacturer and do a full preventative maintenance, both the minor and the major maintenance, and it helped us so we could actually take pictures and create a really nice SOP for doing that, the maintenance. And then I know it is a lot of money, so these smaller breweries, it can be tough on their pocket. So I would say if you do want to save some money, at least spend the money on the first maintenance and just take really good notes. And, you know, we just take it apart. An issue we are having is the more hazy beers we deal with, the more stress it's putting on not just our brew system, but also the centrifuge itself. So you may have to do it more frequently. I would say just open up your centrifuge occasionally and look at it and determine how often you're going to need to do those maintenances and, you know, just act accordingly.
I think that's good. And I got a little bit of advice. Whether or not you're doing your machine yourself, or if you're bringing a manufacturer in to do the maintenance work, it sounds really silly, but I can't tell you how many times I've seen people digging through trash cans looking for a gasket. Count and make sure you have every single gasket in your rebuild kit. And those of you that have not done that before and been caught with it probably know exactly what I'm talking about. It's a small piece of advice and it sounds kind of silly, but I would strongly suggest make sure you got everything before you even take the machine apart.
No, that's great. That's a kind of perfect practical advice people need to hear. So that's perfect. Thank you.
With planned maintenance, I also think it's important to mention that whether you're doing it yourself or hiring someone to do it, make sure that you're not using you're using the right tool. So don't use a screwdriver to take out a nylon gasket. Use a material that's softer than the metal that you're going up against, because if you create scratches and dings, things like this, they add up and decrease the efficiency of the machine. Never use Scotch-Brite or an abrasive pad on the distack or any of the bowl and internals. If you take the finish off of the distack, it'll start catching particles and it'll get dirty much faster and wear much faster. So you want to use materials that won't damage the bowl internals.
Just to add on the point about, not creating any scratches or anything like that, you know, just a quick tip is always have enough space laid out to do your job. Nice, large, clean space, you know, and that also for like not scratching anything, that goes to like where you're going to place your parts, you know, just be super conscious of making sure that even the surfaces you're putting these things on are softer if you have to use, you know, a flat or something like that, and that it's totally clean, free of dust and everything too. Just those little details add up pretty quick.
Okay. Becky, do you have additional questions that we didn't get to? Because you might be the newest centrifuge operator on the call, I believe. Is there anything else that we didn't cover that you either had or has come up since this discussion started?
Yeah, I certainly would agree. I'm the most inexperienced fuge operator, so thank you all for clarifying many of the questions that I've had and taking the time to hang out today. Just one clarification regarding flow rate. I hate to beat a dead horse. So we're only controlling the flow rate from the back pressure valve. It sounded like we should also be controlling inlet flow rate, and I'm wondering how we should go about that. I think we have, and I may be wrong, I think it was called a gate valve that is before our flow meter, and I'm guessing that is our inlet flow rate adjustment, but I'm not certain, so if anybody has any thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's probably what it is. A gate valve works really well for proportional flow control. So I would use your inlet valve to control flow and your back pressure valve to control back pressure. Now, depending on how slow of a flow rate you go, the back pressure will obviously change the flow rate as well. But I would, if you're going to make changes to flow rate, I'd try to first change your inlet and then you're also going to have to change the outlet, the back pressure valve, because as you change one, the other will change. So once you have a recipe, if you will, for a particular beer where you know that you're going to want 7 bar on your back pressure, change your flow rate with your inlet valve, and then adjust as you're, say, opening that, you're going to want to close your discharge valve so that you keep that 7 bar. Does that make sense? You're changing them at the same time to maintain your back pressure, but change your flow.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm sure that's going to take some scary trial and error over the next couple of runs, but hopefully we can make it work without doing any damage. That's certainly helpful. I appreciate that.
If I recall from my limited experience operating a small machine, I mean, that was the most stressful part of operating the machine, was sort of that transition of like changing those two things at the same time and keeping that pressure from jumping around.
Yeah, we've only been changing flow rate by using back pressure. Now I'm concerned that may have been detrimental, but I'll play the wait and see game with that, I guess. The only other question I guess I have is, we're running at a max of 4 bar on the back pressure, and although I'm sure it's different machine to machine, is there any kind of guideline as to what is too high in terms of back pressure, or is that just something that we'll have to figure out as we go?
It depends on the machine, and particularly the seals that are in the machine. If you've got hydrohermetic or water seals, it's going to be a bit lower. And it's the max is going to be when the internal bowl pressure exceeds what the hydroseal is able to stand, and you're going to end up losing beer out the top of the bowl. If you have mechanical seals, the high end pressure is going to be based on that seal design, and you should be able to find that in your manual or talk to your supplier or manufacturer to get that upper end. Generally, it's going to be around 10 bar with mechanical seals, and like you said, lower with the water seals or the hydrohermetic seals.
That was Becky Rudolph, Lawrence Wiltzke, Morgan Harry, Stephen Lyerly, Andrew Conlin, Chris Clausen, Marco Garcia, and Zach Kelly here on the Master Brewers Podcast. Check the show notes for tons of great links about centrifuge operation. And if you're like Becky and have a great idea for an episode, drop us a line. My fist full of courage. Are you enjoying the Master Brewers Podcast? Let me tell you about a simple way you can help us keep making more. Take a minute to thank our sponsors. There's no way we could produce this show without generous support from sponsors like Hopsteiner, Proximity Malt, BSG, Precision Fermentation, and the Lupulin Exchange. So please, let them know you heard their message on the Master Brewers Podcast and that you appreciate their support.